I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. The House Judiciary Committee was unable to vote yesterday on two articles of impeachment against President Trump. After 14 hours of contentious arguments and name-calling over amendments and evidence and the U.S. Constitution, Trump is charged with the abuse of power by putting pressure on Ukraine to damage his political rival Joe Biden for the president's own political and personal benefit. He's also charged with obstruction of Congress because the White House has refused all House subpoenas for documents and testimony. Yesterday, Republicans introduced a series of amendments that were all shot down, called for an investigation into Hunter Biden, defended the president's behavior, and accused the Democrats of using their hatred of Trump to subvert the will of the voters. Here's how Judiciary Chairman Jerry Nadler ended the session late last night and how the ranking member Douglas Collins and the Republicans responded.
It has been a long 2 days of consideration of these articles, and it is now very late at night. I want the members on both sides of the aisle to think about what has happened over these last 2 days and to search their consciences before we cast our final votes. Therefore, the committee will now stand in recess until tomorrow morning at 10 a.m., at which point I will move to divide the question so that each of us may have the opportunity to cast up or down votes on each of the articles of impeachment and to let history be our judge. The committee is in recess.
Mr. Chairman. There was no consulting from the ranking member on your schedule for tomorrow, in which you just blown up schedules for everyone. You chose not to consult the ranking member on a schedule issue of this magnitude.
So typical.
This is the kangaroo court that we're talking about.
She's outrageous.
It's more Stalin-esque than
unbelievable.
Not even consult.
Just Stalin-esque. Let's have a dictator. It's good to hear about that.
10 a.m.
Unbelievable.
I should add that they are voting right now on the obstruction of Congress impeachment article. Joining us is Ross Baker. He's a professor of political science at Rutgers University. Ross, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be back, Marty.
Nice to have you back. Also with us, Margaret Taylor, and she's a fellow of governance studies at the Brookings Institution, senior editor of Lawfare, joining us from the studios of Brookings. And Margaret Taylor, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much for having me, Marty.
I wrote one interview last night. I came in and changed my interview around, and now we're going to go back to my original one because the House is now voting on obstruction of Congress impeachment, one of the articles of impeachment. Let me begin with you, Ross. What did we learn yesterday?
Well, I think the public had an opportunity to see what a markup was. It's a rather bizarre example of it. But that's what it was, which, of course, is the process of amending a bill before it actually gets final floor action. But I think they saw a display of polarization unparalleled in terms of its kind of poisonous rhetoric and accusations. It was the House of Representatives at its most disobedient and unruly.
Let me turn to you, Margaret. On the one hand, this is historic. It has only happened a couple of times before in U.S. history. But if you watched yesterday, it did certainly look partisan. It looked personal. It was petty at times. It was painful to watch at times as well. What did you learn yesterday?
So, to me, I wasn't that surprised at all by sort of the tone and tenor of this markup from yesterday. If you've kind of been watching the proceedings over time, it's really become clear that this is going to be a partisan vote. There will be partisan votes on these articles of impeachment. So all of that is not surprising. The partisanship is not surprising. Also, I just want to say, in terms of, you know, it being personal and there sort of being a lot of shouting and all of that, I just want to point out that's not that unusual for the House of Representatives. And it's also not that unusual when you have historically, these very contentious hearings. A few months ago, I went back and looked at like the Army McCarthy hearings. And it's really kind of surprising how, you know, people, it wasn't so genteel then either. People did get personal. People did get pointed. I see this sort of as not so outside the norm, actually, of how the in particular the House often will conduct these types of contentious hearings.
Well, Russ, let me go back to you and let's talk about the hearings involving President Nixon and then President Clinton. How do you compare and contrast what we're observing today?
Well, it was a gentler time. I'm sure that many people think that the Clinton impeachment was very contentious, and indeed it was. But the kind of gridlock of polarization hadn't quite taken hold of the way it has now. Back in 1973, 74, in that era, you were able to get people to basically accept some of the arguments of the opposition. You had Republicans, people like Representative Charles Wiggins, very early in the procedures, clearly felt that the Democrats had made their case for impeachment. But, you know, Margaret and I are both Senate people, so
yes.
I think we have a kind of built-in prejudice against
yes.
the House
we'll
of Representatives.
We'll get to the Senate.
another thing is I like to point out that congressional committees have their own personalities. And some committees, actually, Democrats and Republicans get along quite well. You know, right now, for example, the appropriations committees of both houses have been able to fund the government, at least on a temporary basis. And I think that the Judiciary Committee, particularly in the House, has always been something of a bear pit.
A bear pit. Let me just say that just because we are live while this vote took place and the House Judiciary Committee did vote to impeach President Trump on abuse of power and also obstruction of Congress. Margaret, let me go back to you. These are not sort of crimes as we understand it. President Clinton lied to a grand jury. That is a crime. These are not crimes in the sort of typical sense that we understand them. Help us understand what impeachment is as compared to a being charged with a crime.
Sure. It's a really good question and one that has come up a bunch in these hearings, and I think Americans are wondering as well. Most legal scholars, and maybe all legal scholars, agree that it is not necessary that the president commit a statutory crime, like a crime that's laid out in the U.S. criminal code, in order to be impeached. You know, when our founders were writing this Constitution, there was no federal criminal code, actually. And so that is not a requirement of being impeached. And in these two articles, we do see that. So, for example, the abuse of power article the abuse of power obviously is not something that appears in our criminal code. The word bribery does appear yeah. in our criminal code as well as in the Constitution. And the abuse of power article does seem to kind of lay out the outlines of what we think of as bribery, but it doesn't use that term. And so I do think that House Democrats made a sort of deliberate decision not to use the word bribery. And I suspect it's because they did not want to be sort of drawn into a sort of rabbit hole argument about whether these facts and this conduct meet the criminal statutory definition of bribery. So I think that kind of explains one aspect of Article 1, which refers to abuse of power. And in addition, I just would say, you know, sure. the impeachment proceeding is not a criminal proceeding. The punishment, if the president is impeached by the full House and then removed by the Senate, is removal from office and then potentially also a prohibition on running for office again. It is not a proceeding that puts the president in jail or anything like that. So it is not at its heart a criminal proceeding. It is a political proceeding, and that is how the founders laid it out in our Constitution. These were meant to the impeachment articles in the Constitution were meant to be a check on a president that was sort of offending the political nature of our system. For example, in this instance, sure. An attempt to influence elections.
Ross, let me go back to you. And again, if people watched, and I think it was certainly worth watching, you got to see the power of the majority in the House Judiciary Committee, but also the power of the minority introducing all these amendments to these two articles of impeachment. How did you see that?
Well, you know, I think it's important for people to understand that the House is preeminently a majoritarian institution. That if you have 218 votes in the House of Representatives, you can pretty much do what you want. Unlike the Senate, which still has the filibuster, at least on legislation, In the House of Representatives, it's understood that the chair of a committee really does run the committee. The chair is responsible for the structure of the witnesses, how many are for a bill or against a bill, and so on. So I think that, you know, Congressman Collins's indignation, I think, was a little bit over the top, in light of the fact that the chair of a House committee really is the master of his or her own domain.
And yet it dragged on for 14 hours last night. I mean, and obviously people get to have their say. That's important. And Ross, I guess there is a kind of a clock that is also at work in a hearing such as this.
Well, that's right. I think that there's a political clock for sure, and I think the Democrats were running against it. I think it was very important for the Democrats not to have this procedure kind of bleed into the political season. I think they do expect that the entire thing will be concluded probably in January. And in this, I think they have the agreement of Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader of the Senate, who I think wants to get this over with as quickly as possible. This has put him at odds with the president, who I think would really like to see some kind of constitutional extravaganza played out in the Senate. I don't think he's going to get his wish.
Well, I do want to talk about the Senate, but I do want to ask you, Margaret, there was something that was said by the representatives on the Judiciary Committee before they spoke, and they would say, strike the last word. As a non-legal person, where does that come from and what does it mean?
So, I'm not a House person.
Right.
So what I can tell you is that it is a way for it's essentially a way to signal to the chairman under the existing rules that a person wants to speak. I actually can't tell you exactly where it has come from, but I've heard it so many times. You're not wrong to ask the question, but at this point, it's so rote in my mind. it is required under the rules in order for someone to sort of get their 5 minutes.
And we were witnessing something called a markup. Ross, we're almost up in a break here. A markup, but it was in public. Having the cameras on, does that change the dynamic in a committee such as this?
Well, I've always been in favor of open markups because it allows the public actually to see how the pig is being cut up into various portions. But I think that in this particular instance, I think the public has seen a markup at its worst in many ways. My belief in the closed markup is that basically it gives members an opportunity to confer among themselves outside of the observation of lobbyists and journalists and so on. It's kind of an opportunity for members to huddle. A public markup is a very different kind of thing, and the performance art of the members is very much on display.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Ross Baker and Margaret Taylor. The president has been impeached as of a vote just a couple of minutes ago. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is
supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. The House Judiciary Committee just approved the Trump impeachment charges, charged with the abuse of power by putting pressure on Ukraine to damage a political rival for the president's own political and personal benefit. Also charged with obstruction of Congress because the White House refused all House subpoenas for documents and testimony. It now moves to the full House for a vote, and if the full House votes on impeachment, it will go to the Senate for a trial. Joining us, Ross Baker, professor of political science at Rutgers University, and Margaret Taylor, fellow of governance studies at the Brookings Institution and senior editor of Lawfare. You can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. This is a historic day. Only a couple of times in U.S. history has a president been impeached. Margaret, let me go to you. And one of the articles of impeachment had to do with the obstruction of Congress because the White House refused to abide by any subpoenas, either to hand over documents or to allow for testimony. What we heard from the Democrats was this was unprecedented. It had never happened before. Is that true?
It is true. This president has handled Congress in a really unprecedented way. Typically, when there are disagreements about access to information that the executive branch has, as between the Congress and the president, it's often contentious. It's often, you know, there's disagreement. This was true under Obama. It was true under basically every president since the Nixon presidency. But usually what happens is there is a back and forth and there ends up being some kind of accommodation. So, for example, the president might say, OK, we're going to give you, Congress, this type of documents, but not these types of documents. There ends up being a negotiated compromise. That is not at all what has happened here. Instead, President Trump, in his own words, said, we are defying all the subpoenas.
Right.
And in this context, in the context of impeachment, White House counsel Pat Cipollone issued a letter in October basically saying, you know, this is not essentially, you know, this is not a valid proceeding, so we're not going to respond at all. And in addition, the president and the White House counsel did direct all of the witnesses, all the people who were subpoenaed to be witnesses in this impeachment proceeding, not to appear. The people that did go in, particularly the government employees that went in and did, you know, give a deposition and then testify in public, they were doing that against the direction of their agency and the president. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and as far as I know, no one has lost their job as a result of their testimony. Russell, let me turn to you. We heard yesterday Senator Mitch McConnell, if it goes to the Senate, obviously that's where the trial takes place. He apparently told Fox News that he was consulting with the White House on their defense. How unprecedented is that?
Oh, I think that it would certainly be the case that a president and a Senate majority leader of the same party would certainly confer on the trial. I don't think there's anything particularly unusual about that. I could be wrong, but that's certainly my impression.
Is that your impression as well, Margaret?
So that is my impression. I just would point out, though, you know, if you kind of telescope back a little bit and look at this and think about what the founders had in mind. I mean, you know, when Madison was writing the Constitution, he said, you know, he's sort of his mind designed it so that ambition would counteract ambition as among the branches of government. But what we see here is that political parties have really kind of changed that dynamic. And this kind of cooperation you see between within the political party, I do think is in this tension with what we think of as the Madisonian conception of separation of powers, where each body is sort of supposed to do its role and perform, you know, its role in the system. But I think what we're seeing here, it is a little bit like the fix is in when the president and the majority leader are sort of discussing how this is all going to turn out and how the Senate trial will, and this is what Mitch McConnell said publicly, will be done consistent with sort of the president's political needs.
Can I just
step in here for a second and second what Margaret was saying? You know, Madison said that the interests of the man and the interests of the institution coincide, and that members of Congress would be defenders of their institution, in this case, Congress. And this was really one of the operative principles of separation of powers, when he said ambition must counteract ambition. And I think what we've seen here is a relinquishment of institutional patriotism on the part of Senator McConnell in defending the Senate as an institution against the presidency. And since the Senate has kind of been co-opted into the executive branch for purposes of strategy in terms of the Senate trial.
Well, and Ross, it was such an interesting argument coming from the Republicans. we didn't hear them say, look, what the president did was wrong. I don't like it, but it is not worthy of impeachment. They basically said what the president did was okay. And I noticed yesterday there were a lot of questions coming from the Democrats saying, will you defend the notion of a president calling on a foreign government to intervene in a presidential election? I didn't hear an answer, but what do you make of that?
Well, the Republicans' talking points have changed over time. At some point they say, well, nothing really bad happened. Or they've also said, well, it may have been bad, but it's not impeachable. So it's kind of hard to diagram the Republicans' talking points. And I think they were, in a sense, kind of searching around for the best argument to make. And whatever suited the particular moment, that's the argument they made.
Well, and the president has even said publicly or defended what he did publicly and said a couple of months ago, Ross, you know, let's have China do the same thing and investigate the Bidens.
That's right. I mean, all of these things are on the record. But I think that the battle lines are so firmly drawn that even the best evidence, even the most dramatic testimony, as was the case with the members of the diplomatic corps and the people from the National Security Council, who at great personal cost, not just their jobs, but you know, opening themselves up to all kinds of harassment and all kinds of online vilification. The best constitutional arguments just don't stand up against real, you know, hard partisan passions.
I mean, Margaret, all of this has been so out in the open, whether it's the president making pronouncements or what the whistleblower said or the transcript from the White House of the phone call, what Rudy Giuliani has been doing. We're going to get to him later in the hour. But that's what's so curious is it's all out there for us to see.
It is. And I think the question for Americans going forward and what I think Americans hopefully we'll be thinking about is, you know, is this conduct that the president has engaged in, is it something we as Americans are going to accept going forward? Are we going to accept the idea that it's okay for our president to essentially accept help from a foreign government or solicit a foreign government to interfere in our domestic elections? So, you know, that is a question that Americans will have to grapple with. They probably won't have to grapple with in the context of this Senate trial, because I do think that the Senate will not remove the president. But still, going into the 2020 election, I do think that is a question and an issue that should be brought center, front and center, should be talked about by our politicians going forward, about whether we as Americans are going to accept that as just a normal part of the U.S. presidency going forward. I personally think it should not be acceptable to Americans. I think Americans should really jealously guard the sovereignty of our elections and, you know, just constantly be on guard against foreign interference in our elections. This is precisely the type of interference that our founding fathers sort of inspired our founding fathers to put the possibility of impeachment into the Constitution. I think Americans hopefully will remember that.
That's Margaret Taylor, again, fellow of governance studies at the Brookings Institution. She's also senior editor at Lawfare. Ross Baker with us as well. He's a professor of political science at Rutgers University. We are talking about impeachment. And earlier this morning, the House Judiciary Committee approved Trump's impeachment charges. The vote was 23-17. You can join us. Send us an email. What do you make of what's going on in this country? Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and call us at 1-888-477-9499. You know, Ross, as I was watching, as many people were over the last couple of months, I kept saying to myself, if the president were a Democrat and doing the same things that President Trump has been doing, would the Republicans and Democrats be on the opposite side? I realize there's no way, or we can't really run that experiment, but I found myself worried about that.
Oh, I think it's an old political axiom that where you stand depends on where you sit. And I think they certainly have had the situations been reversed. I have absolutely no doubt that the Republicans would, as they had in the case of the Benghazi investigation, which dragged on interminably and really ended up really quite inconclusively, the Fast and Furious investigation, all of these things showed that the passions once unleashed, really become kind of bipartisan. One of the things I think that troubled me most about some of the Republican arguments on behalf of the president was this effort to normalize the action of a president inviting a foreign power to involve itself in an American election. And yesterday I was alternately amused and horrified by Representative Louie Gohmert of Texas, who is really one of the interesting characters in the House of Representatives, kind of talking about conversations that allegedly took place between President Roosevelt and Joseph Stalin about whether or not the Soviet troops would be allowed to occupy Poland, because Roosevelt was concerned about the Polish vote in Michigan in the 1944 election. I don't know where he got that, but I think it was part of this effort to sort of say, well, it was no big deal, which again, it was one of the many talking points the Republicans kind of tried out before they actually used them.
Well, I don't like to, put attention on things that I think were inappropriate, but also there was discussion, Margaret, yesterday about Hunter Biden's, problems with addiction, and that became a part of this large discussion about impeachment.
Yeah, it was a little disturbing to see that, and there was a Democrat who kind of came back and said, that's not an appropriate sort of thing to talk about in this context. Yeah, I mean, you did specifically see amendments from Republicans seeking to put the focus on Hunter Biden, I essentially read that as an effort to sort of redirect the sort of messaging of this whole thing toward Biden and his son. And so, in a lot of ways, I think we're seeing it's kind of just like a big messaging war almost. And it's a little disheartening, but you see groups of people who are not really grappling with the facts and not able to come to agreement on what the facts are. To the extent there are facts out there that are knowable, mm-hmm. Republicans are supporting the president, holding back, for example, Mick Mulvaney from, being able to come and testify. So it's not a great situation in some ways. It's almost like a fact-free zone. And, the messaging war is the most important thing, which is not a great place for us to be in our democracy.
Certainly not talking about these important constitutional issues. But Ross, it seems we knew the outcome a couple of months ago. I mean, the vote was 23-17 along party lines.
Oh, yes. I don't think there were any surprises at all. I think it took the patience of the saint to watch both the Intelligence Committee's hearings and the Judiciary Committee's hearings. Because what we got were a lot of recycled arguments or kind of trying out novel arguments to see how well they played with the media. It hasn't been, Congress being displayed at its best. And one of the interesting things I think to note is that a great deal of what Congress does these days is messaging, not just in the context of impeachment, but in the context of substituting messaging for legislating. And also, of course, the other thing, of course, is the protection of incumbents. These people care about their jobs, and much of what we see is positioning yourself in such a way as to keep yourself very much in line with what you perceive to be the political leanings of your constituents.
I mean, Ross, it's going to go to the House maybe as early as next week for a full House vote. Do we also know the results of what that vote is going to be?
No, there'll be no surprises. I mean, there'll be more speeches and more talking points. But I think that, you know, in terms of the outcome, at least on the House side, things are pretty well set. It's not quite clear at this point exactly what's going to happen on the Senate side, whether there will be witnesses or not. If there are witnesses, that further complicates matters because then senators can ask questions of witnesses. But mostly I think that Senator McConnell would like this to be done as quickly and as quietly as possible, set aside and move on to other things.
I mean, Margaret, we've been talking about this balance of power or the sort of war of power and words between Congress and the White House. But the courts are also, you know, part of a co-equal branch of government. And in many ways, sidelined during this discussion. On the one hand, you've got the White House refusing to, in a sense, participate in the process. But that has then forced, I think, the House to sort of hurry up this impeachment vote because they don't have time to wait for the courts. Help us understand that. We're about a minute before we have to say goodbye.
Sure. So I just want to say the general counsel of the House of Representatives, Doug Letter, he's actually litigating more cases than all of his predecessors put together. So he's actually going to court on a whole bunch of things. So, for example, the Deutsche Bank case up in New York, the Mazars case, this is access to Donald Trump's accounting and perhaps tax records as well. The House Democrats are doing tons in court. They're not doing it in the context of this impeachment proceeding, though, for two reasons. One is the timing issue, as you say. Their argument is this president did these things as shown in the Mueller report. He did it with Ukraine. He's going to do it again. There's a clear and present danger. We need to impeach him now. And the second reason is that, you know, it would just take a long time. The second reason is that the sole power of impeachment is vested in the House. It's not vested in the president, which is why they're bringing this obstruction article. It's also not vested in the court. So one of the points that the House of Representatives Democrats are making is this is our prerogative. We do impeachment. It's ours. It's not to be decided by either Article 2, the president, or Article 3, the courts. It's our decision.
Well, we have to leave it there, Margaret Taylor. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. And she's Fellow of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution and Senior Editor of Lawfare. Ross Baker, thank you for joining us as well.
Nice to be here, Marty.
And he's a professor of political science at Rutgers University. After this very short break, where's Rudy Giuliani? Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Moss Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. A few minutes ago, President Trump was impeached on two articles of impeachment. And while House committees were debating the impeachment of President Trump, his personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, has reportedly been doing research on a documentary to debunk the impeachment charges. In fact, it was Giuliani's efforts earlier this year that helped lead us all to this constitutional crisis, promoting discredited allegations that it was Ukraine, not Russia, that interfered in the 2016 election, dragging Hunter Biden into the controversy, besmirching the reputation of ousted Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch, and running a parallel foreign policy at odds with the diplomats. Andrea Bernstein joins us by Skype. She is co-host of Trump Incorporated. It's a podcast from WNYC and ProPublica. She's the author of a forthcoming book called American Oligarchs, The Kushners, The Trumps, and the Marriage of Money and Power. Andrea Bernstein, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's so great to be on.
You know, I was thinking of John Bolton's quote, the former national security advisor. He said reportedly, Giuliani is a hand grenade who's going to blow everybody up. Did that turn out to be true?
Well, it does seem to have precipitated all of this. And based on all of the fact witness testimony that we heard in the impeachment hearings earlier this fall, I guess it was still this fall, it does seem like he made an awful lot of very high level U.S. officials very upset by his sort of off the books, quote unquote, diplomacy in Ukraine.
Did he or is he in the process of blowing himself, obviously speaking metaphorically, but blowing himself up in the procedure?
Well, I mean, obviously, I mean, there's a few things we know. First of all, there were, you know, the current ambassador, the former ambassador, other State Department officials, other Trump appointees were very, very concerned about his activities. We saw that. We also know that two of his associates were recently indicted in the Southern District of New York for actions that in open court, it's been discussed that these two have a tangle of business relationships with Rudy Giuliani. These two were indicted for campaign finance violations and lobbying violations and are under further investigation for perhaps other violations of law. Many people who worked in the U.S. Attorney's Office, which should mention Rudy Giuliani led in the 1980s. He was the U.S. Attorney. He was the one doing the perp walks and making the holding the press conferences to announce charges. And now he is under investigation by that same office. Many of his former associates have told me that they think he is in very serious trouble and are expecting some sort of legal hammer to fall.
Do we know what he is, what the office is looking at as it pertains to Giuliani?
Yes. So they're looking at a few things. They're looking at whether any of his activities in Ukraine might have violated the Foreign Agents Registration Act. This is an act that was made into law as a result of Nazis trying to influence U.S. policies in World War II. And it's been around since then. And it basically means you have to declare if you're working for a foreign government so that people in the U.S. government system will understand if you are representing somebody else's interests, perhaps rather than a domestic interest. So that's one question. Did he do that? Another question is, was he involved in any way with the campaign finance violations that his associates have been charged with? Because we do know, mostly from social media, that Rudy Giuliani was traveling at the end of the 2018 campaign with these two gentlemen, Igor Fruman and Lev Parnas, who've been indicted. And then the third thing that CNN is reporting, that they are looking at whether there was a violation of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and whether Igor Fruman and Lev Parnas may have tried to influence a Ukrainian energy official. Still an open question whether Rudy Giuliani was involved in all of that in any way. But it does seem like the U.S. Attorney's Office is examining all of these possibilities.
These two associates, as you said, Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman, I believe it was Igor Fruman's company. I don't know if it still exists, but it is called, and this is not a joke, Fraud Guaranteed, but yes. There you go. But it seems that Rudy Giuliani hired them to do work in Ukraine to try to damage the U.S. ambassador, to look at the Burisma Energy Company, where Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, sat on the board. There's some connection to Shokin, who was the corrupt prosecutor in Ukraine. So all the things that seem to show up in this this indictment now and the impeachment of the president seem to have the fingerprints of Rudy Giuliani.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even the fingerprints. I mean, it's like his face on television, his own words telling us this. He has been very, very public from the beginning about these contacts. And it really is extraordinary because we in the Trumping podcast actually traveled to Ukraine. We had just been kind of thinking, well, Ukraine is a really interesting country. We need to go there.
Yeah.
And it happened as the scandal was breaking. And my colleague, Ilya Marat, spoke to a number of journalists and anti-corruption advocates. And they said, all of them, that the prosecutors that Rudy Giuliani is gathering information from were widely known to be people who fixed cases, who tipped things so suspects that had paid them off would not suffer legal consequences. And in one case, one of the prosecutors, U.S. officials, had been so alarmed that they convinced Ukrainian authorities to put a bug on his fish tank to record him.
His literal fish tank?
I'm sorry?
Did you mean fish tank?
An actual fish tank, yes. That was one of the people that Rudy Giuliani is getting information from. And, I mean, obviously the layers of irony are just so deep. Somebody who was a former prosecutor who was really known for prosecuting corruption. New York really respected him for putting officials in jail. Roy Cohn's law partner Rudy Giuliani personally tried, and he was sentenced to one of the longest ever sentences for political corruption in New York history. That was Rudy Giuliani when he was a prosecutor. Mm-hmm. Now he is in Ukraine meeting with people who are widely known to throw cases and to be corrupt. And those are the people that he just went back to Kyiv this week, last week. It's so hard to keep track to speak with and to make this documentary about. So it's sort of the layers of, you know, sort of openness about what he's doing are really surprising.
And apparently, I think he said, and perhaps even the president said, that Giuliani is going to brief the Justice Department and maybe even some Republican senators on what he found from this latest trip to Ukraine.
Right. And I did actually even see this morning that he was spotted at the White House or on his way to the White House. So he is, you know, sort of believes that he is developing a, you know, a counter narrative. Now, it should be said that it's known by U.S. intelligence officials that the counter narrative that Rudy Giuliani and Donald Trump and their allies are pushing is one that the Russians are pushing, because it exonerates the Russians for their role in interfering in the 2016 election, if true, of which there is no support that it's true. But if it gains support or even credence, which is what Rudy Giuliani is pushing, then it somehow gets the Russians off the hook for what they did in 2016 and paves the way for the lifting of sanctions, which, of course, have caused a lot of economic suffering in Russia. So that is sort of what seems to be at the, you know, that is the what U.S. intelligence officials have said is where this narrative traces from.
Well, we are talking about Rudy Giuliani with Andrea Bernstein. She's co-host of the Trump Incorporated podcast that comes from WNYC, our sister station, another NPR station up there in New York City, and ProPublica. Again, you can join our conversation, Radio Times at WHYY.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Alex had a question saying, isn't the fact that Giuliani was Trump's, or is actually Trump's personal lawyer, a violation of the separation of the branches of government? I mean, he is freelancing, Andrea, and I don't think the president is paying him either.
Right. I mean, it's really uncharted territory here. And we, in fact, we've been asking questions about Rudy Giuliani for about a year and a half now. And we actually did an episode called Rudy Inc. last October, so October of 2018, in which we tried to get to the bottom of what his business ties are, because it's a very strange situation where you have someone who is the unpaid attorney for the president, but is then clearly using his proximity to the president to get business in nations across the world. And we found business in Armenia, business in Romania, business in South America, in the Middle East. He is getting a lot of clients who are, in fact, in some cases, literally just running into him at the Trump Hotel in Washington, understanding that he has is close to the president and he has a lot of power and connections, and hiring him. So it's like he is not making money in the sense of he's not sending legal bills to Donald Trump, but he is certainly profiting from this relationship. But what this means is, because he has no formal relationship, and particularly because he's not a government official in any way, there is no disclosure. So we don't know anything about his business relationships. We don't know whose interests he might be working for, if it's someone other than the American people. And that does seem to be one of the things that prosecutors in New York are looking at, which is, was he working for someone else while also working for the president of the United States?
There's a name that comes up when you see Rudy Giuliani's name. I'm hoping I'm going to pronounce it correctly. Firtash?
Dmitry Firtash, yes. And he has actually also recently come up in the Southern District Court filings. So Dmitry Firtash is a Russian-Ukrainian oligarch who was indicted for his own Foreign Corrupt Practices Act violation back in, I think, 2014, 2015. And he has been fighting it from Vienna ever since. He's been fighting extradition. He's been fighting coming to the U.S. And he made it a particular point in his own legal strategy to attack Joe Biden, because he felt that the Obama-Biden administration was politically targeting him. So he has been on a years-long campaign, well before Joe Biden came up in the context of this impeachment scandal. He has been attacking Joe Biden. And he has hired Lev Parnas,
according to everything and comes actually, full circle. Right. I get it.
Yeah,
I get, no, go ahead.
It came up in court filings this week because prosecutors said they wanted to revoke Parnas's bail because he had lied to them about getting $1 million payment from Russia this September and other things. But they also mentioned his ties to Firtash. And they said, look, an oligarch in Vienna, which is Firtash, has unlimited resources who could help him escape. Therefore, he's a flight risk. Therefore, he needs to go to jail while waiting to face the charges. Now, there is also this. So what you have is you have the situation where Parnas has paid Rudy. Rudy has paid Parnas, and Firtash has paid Parnas apparently. And they share another legal team, which is, I know, it's mind-numbingly
complex.
No,
I know where you're going, but go ahead, say it.
there are two lawyers at a law firm in Washington, Tensing and DeGeneva, Joe DeGeneva and Victoria Tensing, a married couple, who have been hired by Firtash and are also working with Lev Parnas. So there's this series of tangled, intricate relationships. And what the prosecutors in New York have said is, this smells bad and gives us great concern.
Well, let me ask you a couple of questions about the relationship, at least as we observe from the outside, between Rudy Giuliani and President Trump. During the campaign, Giuliani was really one of the few people that went on to defend the president after the Hollywood Access tape went public. He talked about that this was essentially locker room talk. And at the same time, it seems as if what Giuliani has done has really dragged the president into this impeachment. But Giuliani, on the other hand, always looks like such a happy warrior when he's being interviewed on television.
Well, I think, as is clear, President Trump believes he did nothing wrong. He believes his call was perfect and believes he's on the side of right here. So, I mean, from Rudy Giuliani's perspective, he's just helping that along. It's just that the sort of all of the objective experts, including those appointed by Trump who have looked at this, have said it is very, very concerning to be promoting this narrative that the Russians are promoting. There's been bipartisan consensus in American diplomacy circles that Ukraine's efforts to move towards the rule of law need to be supported, that is a U.S. security goal because Ukraine is in the front lines, literally the front lines against Russia. So that is what they say Rudy Giuliani is undermining. But he apparently, and Trump apparently, don't see it that way. They are proud of what they are doing. I mean, that is what they've said. The entire administration is sort of towing that line that the president did nothing wrong. There was no problem here.
A final question. Rudy Giuliani was in Ukraine with the One America News Network, described as a network that's to the right of Fox. What do we, or what do you know, or does anyone know what this network is about and what they were looking for?
Well, I would like to know a lot more about it. I do know that they frequently get questions at the official press conferences with President Trump. But obviously, I mean, one of the things that we've reported and our colleagues at ProPublica have reported is that Giuliani has a series of relationships with press that are willing to publicize or to print his view of things in a way that is sort of, I guess you would say, not really journalistic. And this appears to be the case, that he was in Ukraine meeting with people that corruption activists there have told us are directly tied to the Kremlin, are promoting a narrative that helps Russia and hurts Ukraine. And that's who Rudy Giuliani was recording for this documentary, as he's calling it.
Well, Andrea, we called you up yesterday. You brought some clarity to this conversation. Thank you so much for joining us once again on Radio Times.
Thank you. Great speaking with you.
Nice talking to you as well. That's Andrea Bernstein, co-host of the Trump Incorporated podcast, and it comes out of WNYC and ProPublica, author of a forthcoming book, American Oligarchs, The Kushners, the Trumps, and the Marriage of Money and Power. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.